This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian. The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly live at the Soho Theatre in London. I'm Tom Clark. The Conservatives are only 6 months into their first majority government in a generation, and many are already taking victory in the next election for granted. And yet there are signs that the Tories are running into trouble in the Commons, in the Lords and on the streets. We ask, how can they most effectively be opposed? Plus, the EU referendum looms large over every political debate in Parliament. What concessions can David Cameron win, and what will decide Britain's fate? Joining me for all of this, we have the comedian Matt Ford, the Guardian commentators Hugh Muir and Anne Perkins, and the Labour MP for Walthamstow, Stella Creasy. A warm welcome to all of you, and a warm welcome to our Soho audience here, who we'll be bringing in a bit later on. Now, when the Conservatives won their unexpected outright win in May, David Cameron looked all-conquering. He'd blown the Lib Dems he'd had to rely on before out of the water and put himself in a position to redraw the political map to Tory advantage. And when Labour members then defied their MPs by picking Jeremy Corbyn as his leader, some people were ready to say that Cameron's dominance had become total. And yet, governing in splendid isolation suddenly doesn't seem quite so easy. A small majority relies on a number of MPs who are pretty relaxed about rebelling. The budget came unstuck in the Lords, and trouble lies ahead on Europe. So the Tories look like they should be there for the taking. But how can they be challenged effectively? And by whom? Stella, we'll start with you on this one. I mean, you've been, you're on the back benches now. Is that partly because you think the answer to the whom question isn't Jeremy Corbyn?
No, not at all. I think that there is a challenge. We've got a Prime Minister and a government that didn't think they were going to win an election. So they are now, they've sort of been given the keys to the car and they don't know what to do. And consequently, they're making some really bad choices. I mean, it's not just on tax credits. There's a whole series of issues where their answers to the country are actually not good answers. But the challenge for us as a political party is not just to be an opposition, it is to be an alternative. And if you're going to be that, I think we have to answer on the left what is a very difficult question, and frankly one that came up at the election and came up through the leadership and the deputy leadership, which is, what is the point of the Labour movement? You know, there's no guarantee, there's no rule there has to be a Labour party. There's no guarantee that just because we see David Cameron making bad decisions, people automatically think, well, then Labour is the answer. So in order to be that answer, we've got to be out there rebuilding a relationship with the public and showing that we don't just have an analysis said the Tories are bad, it's that we have a different worldview and a better worldview.
I mean, Matt, the problem is that it's true that David Cameron didn't think he was going to be all-conquering with his overall majority or whatever, but Jeremy Corbyn sure as hell didn't think he was going to be Labour leader.
No, he didn't. But there are a lot of people around him now that are convinced he can be Prime Minister, and that's, I think, the most dangerous line of thinking that currently in the Labour movement. Firstly, I think Jeremy Corbyn will last a lot longer than people think he will, because he's got a huge mandate, and the demographics of the Labour Party have shifted so far to the left that even if Corbyn is removed, no centrist is going to be able to win on that group of people. So this idea that David Miliband comes back from New York and just somehow seizes the Labour Party is harder now than it was last time he got beat, because the Labour Party has shifted massively to the left. I think the Labour Party now is becoming so irrelevant that it's a huge danger to itself, because most people do not identify as Labour or Tory anyway. Most people don't identify as left-wing or right-wing. Most people worry about their house, they worry about their kids, they worry about their job, they worry about their life. They saw at the last election that David Cameron was, of all the choices on offer, the best one for them. They do not look at Jeremy Corbyn and think, great, someone's being left-wing again. They think, I cannot trust him with my job. And as much as those of us who enjoy ideology and enjoy political discussion would like to think that there's some great way that left-wing people can convince the rest of the country that Corbyn's great, we know where this ends. It ends in defeat, and it ends with 5 more years of the Tories after this 5 years.
Now, Hugh, I mean, I'm someone who's intermittently seen bits of hope in the Corbyn stuff, in the sense that there are clearly some very bad ideas that needed to be challenged, and here's a movement that's ready to challenge them. But the last week in particular, culminating in the suspension of Corbyn's policy chief, not from his job, but from the Labour Party, is a kind of... It's Life of Brian stuff, isn't it?
There are a number of things I didn't think about, and one of the things they've got to move away from is this almost shamaterism. They started off with this sense that, look, we're going to do politics and it's going to be completely different, it's not going to be like the other lot did it, but I think the public pretty quickly pick up on what they see as just being as bungle and shambles, and I think that's kind of how it looks now, that just obvious things that they should be doing, procedural things, protocol things, that they're not doing, and I think the public picks up on that. I think they also have to think about, they can't face the public with this show of obvious infighting. Yeah. The public doesn't like the People's Front of Judean People's Front. Again, they have a very obvious antennae for that as well. And so I think that has to stop pretty quickly as well. And one thing that's, if anything more serious, is that I think that there's lost sight of the wider narrative in terms of opposing this government. It's easy to oppose this government piecemeal in terms of different things they do. But if you look at George Osborne, for example, what is he doing? Is he actually reacting to a set of circumstances that faced him? Is he staving off kind of disaster with this kind of acute surgical operation on the economy? Or is he just doing what we knew he wanted to do right at the outset, which was to shrink the state? Saying this is the narrative, this is actually what's happening here, folks. Actually confronting the government more philosophically would be... more fruitful than just trying to attack them in a pretty incompetent way, piecemeal.
Although, Anne, these mishaps for the Conservatives, there is a kind of attrition effect, isn't there? Particularly with the budget coming unstuck, because that was seen as such a triumph back in July, and now it looks like a complete mess.
Well, I agree. Obviously, it doesn't look good. I think let's kind of just stick briefly with the bigger problem, because I don't disagree with anything anyone said so far. But we're talking to two different people, two different groups of people here. We're the people who want competence and who want answers, want to feel confident that their job and their kids' schooling and their house and their prospects of getting on are being looked after by the Labour Party is one group. And the people, especially the young kids who are just burning for something that is authentic and wants change, also need to be addressed and responded to. And I think there's a real problem if Labour, seeking to be a good opposition, which of course it must do, excludes them again from the debate. So I think there's a really, really hard balance to be struck here. You kind of almost need two parties, and it does not help if the PLP is going to be operating as the Judean People's Front against the People's Front of Judea. And on the narrower question of the budget, age, sorry, but I just remember the 80s and how often we thought, Thatcher can't continue like this. This is clearly a catastrophe. Look at those unemployment. And she did. She went on winning elections. I agree it looks a shambles right now. They're going to change the boundaries. They're going to give themselves a built-in majority. Mm. It's going to be really, really hard for any Labour Party to win the next election. So I think it's a very tough place to be. It was
but
a bad election
point,
to lose.
Once you control the narrative, as Thatcher controlled the narrative as well, you can do more or less what you want. And you won't be opposed for it. You can't be opposed for it. And that's why the narrative is so important.
You need permission to control the narrative, it seems to me. And I think that's where the competence has to come in to challenge that control of the narrative. And I think Osborne has such a... Osborne is so sure he knows where he's going, he's going to be really hard to...
But that's why it's all the more sort of shocking for people when actually you see him messing up. Look, the tax credits is a mess. It's bad for the economy. He's managed to get our economy... out of recession by getting all of us to pay more, right? So that's why personal debt is rocketing in this country, because he's balancing the books out of the pockets of people. So when you take money out of people's pockets, and we're talking about £1,100 on average a year out of people's pockets, it's not just that those people are going to be harder up, it's actually that the economy is going to slip back, because he's not dealt with any of the fundamental problems underneath it. What I think the challenge is for all of us, I agree and disagree with a lot of what you're saying. Look, frankly, Hugh, if people were that interested in what we were doing, I'd take that as a win right now, because my worry is that people don't think that politics makes a difference at all. They've never trusted people like me. Try being a politician in a pub on a Friday night. The number of jokes you get is horrific. Yeah. But now what they think is, even if I could trust you, you couldn't do it anyway. And actually, if you are a political movement that believes in the power of collective effort, then the idea there's not really much point in getting involved is the problem. Mm. That's where I disagree with you, Matt, in terms of what you're saying about the membership. Look, I've spent the last 4 or 5 months going around meeting these people, and actually, on the whole, they come from a whole range of different political backgrounds. What all of them share in common is they want there to be a point to all of this, right? So they've joined on the idea that actually something different is happening. Okay. What that different is, they don't know. And that's the challenge for all of us. And I guess my worry, and where I see it both within Parliament and in the country, is if we slip back into bad habits that it's all about the machinations of what's going on in Parliament, we'll lose all those people. We won't have answered that question about what is the point of the Labour Party. And therefore, Osborne and Cameron get away with being incredibly incompetent because it doesn't look like there's any alternative. And the discipline for all of us is to have that debate, not just in the halls of Committee Room 15, but out in the country. And that's why I'm on the backbenches, because frankly, I want to spend as little time as possible in Hogwarts Gone Wrong and as much time out there being part of that alternative movement.
Well, but how do you, I mean, you know, people will get their politics through the media insofar as they have politics at all. And, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's got his new way of doing PMQs. It's worked okay. And yet it's no longer a news story. The news story now is that, like, people are in rival factions are talking about expelling one another. How do you stop that?
See, actually, what I think that does is it proves something which I felt for a long time in the Labour movement. The mistake we've made is thinking it's all about one person. With the greatest will in the world, even having a really charismatic leader, and I know we're going to talk about your favourite Mr Blair in a minute now, but it's not enough anymore. Because actually, if we want our politics, if we want the left to be able to answer that question about what is the point of having a Labour Party in the 21st century, all of us have to be part of it. All of us have to lead what that difference looks like. Because it can't just be about the size of the state anymore. That is a dead-end question to a lot of those young people that you're talking about who live in networks where they are as influenced by what they read on the internet from their friends, from activists they've heard about in Iran or Afghanistan or in America, as it is about the very micro things happening in their everyday community. Now, I welcome that, actually. I welcome the fact that people are networked. But it means you need a different type of left-wing politics. And that can't just be about one person, however good or bad they are at the front. You know, I think what Jeremy's done is to start that conversation about what would different look like, but all of us have to answer if it's going to be effective.
I think if you want an end to the factionalism and the sort of chaos that we're going to see over the next 5 years, don't appoint people that openly campaign for the parties at the next election, make them your head of policy. Don't make someone a shadow chancellor that rants and raves at every meeting. If you're serious about giving Osborne a run for his money, pick serious people who are intelligent and have political judgment. All these things are summed up, and I would say in a word, which is judgment, which is all this, the sort of shambles that you talk about. I do not believe Jeremy Corbyn has sound political judgment. I don't think Andrew Fisher does. I don't think John McDonnell does. Mm. And he's surrounded himself by people that enjoy ranting and raving, calling Tories bastards at rallies and making themselves sort of chuckle to themselves. To the rest of the public, it is not just repellent,
Point scoring really isn't just one way, is it? You know, we've had the PLP this week elect John Woodcock, who thinks the Labour Party was invented to build Trident, in charge of the Defence Backbench Committee. Mike Gapes, who's a kind of, ultra Blairite on the kind of foreign policy front, in charge of the Foreign Policy Committee. Now, those look like deliberate snubs. Also, some of the people who, like Emily Benn, who's been in these Twitter row with Andrew Fisher, has talked about people maybe leaving Labour and joining the Women's and Equality Party. The point with this stuff is it can go both ways, can't it?
I think if you're really objective about this stuff, as you had to be around the Scottish referendum, you'd see that it is broadly coming from one direction. And it's broadly coming from a...
Yeah, Zayn Malik, he's got
Well, I think it's broadly coming from one group of people. And people on the left can sort of pretend that the people they like aren't
Simon
really
Dan
being
Chuck.
Nasty if they want. Simon Danchuk's not in a position of power. Andrew Fisher is. John McDonnell is. And Simon Danchuk has never said, I'll give you straight talking, honest, kind politics. It's the reality of this is, this will be Corbyn's back to basics.
Yeah.
Is when you preach one thing to the public and say, we're now going to be... Remember how Tony Blair got himself into trouble with Whiter Than White? The moment that politicians say, what defines me against you is actually that I'm better and that I'm more moral, you are setting yourself up for the biggest catastrophe you could ever want, because people are human, they fail, they get aggressive, they get jealous, they brief against each other in other parties. It's got nothing to do with ideology. And the reality is if you pretend that you're not human and you pretend that you are straight all the time, Corbyn's already come and done with it. I'll answer every question straight. We bow to the Queen. I didn't know that's what it involved. Well, that's what it does involve. Well, I don't know. Within a day, too busy to meet the Queen, too busy to go on Andrew Marr. It's not straight talking, it's not honest. So already, it begins to erode.
I think what the challenge is, and it's something I've tried to say to people for a long time now, is 600,000 people who agree with each other all the time on absolutely everything is not a political party, it's a cult. right? The Labour Party shouldn't be the Moonies. So we should be able to have debates, have disagreements, have genuine differences about the way forward, and think that that's healthy. And I speak as a former chief whip on a local council that was hung, so you can imagine some of the debates I had to try and manage within that group of people. And we didn't always get that right. And as a result, we weren't able to make progress. The point here isn't that everyone has to agree all the time. The point is that you have to talk about what your priorities are. And that has to be done in an environment of curiosity and kind of willingness to hear and disagree and not think that's the end of a relationship rather than people shouting each other down. And Matt is right that there is growing a culture, and I see it offline and online, where people think that it's about winning every single argument rather than saying, OK, we can disagree, but what are our priorities for action? And my worry for the Labour movement, as my worry for all campaigns and organisations I've ever been involved in, is when you start thinking it's more about winning in the room rather than winning out there in the public, we don't make progress. And I don't want to spend the next 4 years sitting on the sidelines. I want the Labour movement to be leading the debates in this country. That's how we show we're not just an opposition, we're an alternative government in waiting, because my God, look at what we can do now and imagine what would happen if we put us back in office. That's the challenge for us.
Mac, can I just press you on, what's your analysis of why the right in the recent elections did quite so badly? Because it wasn't just the people who paid £3 to join up. It was even Corbyn was first, wasn't he, amongst even
he was amongst
Labour
existing
members.
He got 50% I think on existing members, he got 8% on new members. I think in general the centre ground of British politics is not prone to activism. Most people in the centre are in the centre because they're fairly chilled out and they're not that bothered about joining political parties. That's why when political parties go in a certain direction, the public is almost certainly going in a different direction because they're not that bothered about politics. Therefore, people who go on marches and go on Stop the War things, and all these things are great in certain regards, are more likely to be part of a Facebook group called Fuck the Tories than someone who is not that bothered about politics but voted for Blair and voted for Major and, you know, probably voted for Cameron.
But Matt, isn't it?
People in the centre aren't predisposed to getting involved.
Isn't it because the right didn't really have anything to sell?
Absolutely not. The right's always got something to say. This idea, and I think I would challenge that, the idea that the right had nothing to say is not true, has never been, and never will be. The left always has something to say, the right always has something to say. Whether they have it, whether they're organised enough, whether they pick the right candidate are two very different things. But the idea that the right of the Labour Party doesn't have anything to say, I mean...
But Corbyn, throughout the election, had what was a pretty clear philosophy. You can accept it, you can reject it, but it was clear. The candidates from the other side of the party didn't have any clear philosophy. It was mix and match. It was make and mend.
I wouldn't say for Liz Kendall. I think Liz Kendall was clear.
I feel like I need to stand up for every single one of my colleagues in the PLP, whether it's John Woodcock, Mike Gopes, Liz Kendall, any of these people. Everybody has a contribution to make. If you want everyone to make their contribution, be respectful, listen to it, and engage with what they're saying. Don't dismiss them as people. That is disrespectful. That is not equality in action.
There wasn't. It didn't seem to me that there was a clear post-Blairite philosophy for the right of the party. Now, it's always a danger to put Tony Blair's name into anything because then someone will throw your right back at you. But if you look at the domestic policy, if you like, if you look at the larger achievement of those Blairite years, that was great. There were three terms in that. But then at some point, the party needed to move on from that, and the right of the party needed to have a philosophy that was a post-Blairite philosophy.
I agree.
None of that came over in the leadership election.
I think some of it did. You saw Liz Kendall defending good free schools, which I think was a big thing for a Labour candidate to be saying in a leadership election. You had, I think, Liz Kendall broadly accepting the post-Blair economic consensus. It wasn't that it was there. It not being there and people not liking it are two different things. And maybe it not having enough broad support within the party is a different thing. There is a right-wing view that, well, not right within the Labour Party. And I think the biggest shame is that there seems to be very little creative thought in the Labour movement at all. Jeremy Corbyn is not providing us with anything new. He's providing us with something different to what we had under Blairism. It's older than most of the politics of the Labour Party, what Corbyn is presenting. Equally, on the right, why are there not people in the Labour Party saying, why don't we think again about right to buy? Why don't we think again about grammar schools? Provoke a little bit. What frustrates me is that there's a presumption that those people on the right of the Labour Party are Tories in disguise. And the Labour Party needs to shed itself for that. If Liz Kendall was a Tory, she would have joined the Tory Party. If Tony Blair was a Tory, he'd have joined the Tory Party, he'd have probably led it to three election victories.
Correspondingly, Anne, though, there's whole new areas where the Labour Party left all right doesn't seem particularly interesting. We're looking at this business about the surveillance bill that came in this week. Theresa May brought her draft surveillance bill forward, and Andy Burnham more or less stood up and said, thanks for taking the time to bring it here.
I think that's... I mean, that's a kind of really good example of perhaps a bit of a tendency to kind of put it in the all kind of too hard to think about bracket, and, you know, really tricky to develop a considered and different but credible alternative strategy. And I think, you know, I just, I'm not quite sure that he was kind of ready to do that. And let's face it, you know, we care deeply about it. We wish everybody else cared about it, but the truth is, they don't.
I think, though, I mean, look, Matt is right about the ecosystem around progressive. You know, what was amazing, you know, I sound very old now. Actually, in fact, older than you, Matt. Was
in, you don't look
I know,
it.
Well, you know,
I'm knackered.
I've got more plastic surgery. The mid-1990s, that wasn't just the Labour Party. There was a whole ecosystem of organisations, of trade unions, of think tanks, of campaigning organisations, feeding into that sense that if Labour was going to win again, we had to be both credible and radical. It wasn't enough to be either. You had to be both. And that's why in 1997, there was this kind of amazing period of like, right, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. And it told a story, it told an alternative country future. I mean, for God's sake, we had a Prime Minister who got up and pledged to abolish child poverty. And I look back on that now, and I think, and I see what's happening in my local community, and I feel so frustrated and angry, because that felt at the time like a big choice to make. What we didn't realise is we had to keep fighting for those things. You needed that ecosystem. And I think, actually, on the debates around security and liberty, I have real concerns about that piece of legislation, not just in terms of the balance between security and liberty, but also in terms of the technology. You know, one of the things for the Labour movement is, what is the future world coming towards us? How do we work in a world where actually our kids are going to be competing with kids in China, in Brazil, and they're competing not just in terms of a single job, but in terms of whole industries, in terms of whole skill sets? That is just a different world to be around in. Millions of people in this country now are self-employed. They want a different type of social charter. They need us to fight for a different working environment for all of them. And within that, a whole series of questions about where is security best held? How do you deal with threats that are based in other countries but are very immediate here are coming up? We have to be able, as we were in the 1990s, through that ecosystem, to learn and lead from the middle out into that world. That's quite a tricky place to be for us.
So I think it's really interesting looking at how you got to 1997. And obviously there was a huge help that the Tories completely fell apart. But it had also been a very, very long time in the construction and the building and the analysis, hadn't it?
But we also have to reckon... Look, I disagree with you, Matt, about the right or left, because actually I think one of the challenges for us is, you know, remember Tony Blair never sent an entire email whilst in office, right? Tony Blair would look at the world today and go, what we talked about in the mid-1990s isn't what we need to be talking about in 2015, let alone what's coming in 2030. So where are those ideas? Where is that ecosystem of people saying, have you seen what's happening in the security industries? Have we seen what's happening with technology? Because frankly, if somebody invents another form of Skype, will this IP bill keep up with it is the question for us, as much as how are people using technology to organise for good and bad around the world? Those are the challenges that I want us to be focused on, because my community needs us to do that.
Well, on Politics Weekly, we promise to keep you posted with all the bumps in the road for the Labour Party in the coming months, of which I'm sure there'll be many. But there's also one almighty one coming up for the government in the form of the EU referendum. David Cameron's all set to finally put pen to paper on his list of reforms that he wants from the European Union. Most of the kind of general headings are kind of half known now. He wants to scrap the phrase ever closer union from the EU treaties. He wants to do something, but he's not quite sure what, about benefits for EU migrants. And he wants to do more work to complete the single market. It's a pretty hazy and heavily watered down list, isn't it? But like, can you imagine when we finally get the wish list, even if it comes off, anyone being satisfied by it?
No, I mean, that's it. He will know that straight away. Whatever he asks for, those who were sceptical of the whole process were going to say, well, you've just done that to get an easy answer and then you come to us and we know how you're going to campaign in the referendum itself. So I think yeah, he may as well be honest about that, put things on his list that he actually wants, but not think that he's going to satisfy the sceptics, because he's never going to satisfy the sceptics. I think the real problem with this is kind of with him. I agree with the piece that Polly Toynbee wrote a little while ago, which said the biggest danger for us in Europe is the fact that David Cameron mucks everything up. Because even if he really does want us to stay in, his record of delivery is pretty awful. And he just may foul it up. He doesn't control his own party very well. He doesn't perform very well when he goes over to these international summits. He doesn't have much by way of clout. And so the worry is that even though the case for staying in is, to me, pretty watertight, he may well make may well foul it up.
It sort of feels more losable than you might have hoped, Stella, doesn't it?
I think this is why one of the challenges of people like me, who absolutely think Europe has to change and absolutely are horrified by what the alternative would be, and I think that's one of the things about these debates, is we're talking as though it's in or out. Actually, it's in or an alternative model, and what is that alternative model, whether it's Norway, whether it's Iceland, that we've got to say, well, that's a choice we face, is that we can't let David Cameron and George Osborne define the terms of the debate about what the EU offers Britain. In my lifetime, it's been the European Union working with Labour governments that have delivered some of the most progressive things I've ever seen, whether it's not just on employment rights and maternity rights, but also on international development, on climate change. When you look at the world to come, the idea that you don't want ways of cooperating with other countries to deal with things like terrorism, to deal with things like the global economy, climate change, movements of people, it doesn't make any sense to us. But if we let David Cameron and George Osborne define the terms of the debate about what Europe is, and the very narrow terms about the things that they want to negotiate. I mean, this is a man, you know, the debate around Juncker kind of proved it all, where he actually managed to secure the job for the man, having said there are problems, by the way in which he campaigned against him. You know, we can't let him say what cooperation offers, but we have to set out that alternative.
Matt, which way do you think this is going?
I think we'll stay in Europe, but what frustrates me most is Cameron's the Prime Minister of the country and therefore is the most powerful cheerleader for keeping Britain in the EU. And it's only recently, it seems, sort of made his mind up that that's what he wants to happen. So I worry about the integrity of the campaign that he'll run. I also worry about the tone in which the campaign is conducted, because the Scottish referendum showed us that people will allow certain behaviour from their own side that is frankly completely unacceptable to most decent people, because they feel that this is something worth fighting about. And I just hope that, I don't think it's a hope that will be realised. I think the campaign's going to be very, very nasty. And don't underestimate the lengths to which both sides will go. And don't allow your own side, even though you agree in the ends, to behave in a way that is reprehensible, because that is almost certainly going to happen. There'll be scaremongering on both sides. There'll be ridiculous headlines, stupid press releases, awful personal attacks. Don't treat your own side any better than you would treat your enemies. And I fear that actually we're in for a nasty year, but be a good laugh on it.
Anne's going to have a quick word on this, and then we're going to questions. Anne, do you think it's going to end up being more interesting than people thought as Scotland was?
Well, I hope it does. I think Europe as it is now is broken. I think all my instincts are to stay in, but that's partly kind of a generational thing. But what I want to hear from Cameron, but especially I want to hear from Labour, is an idea about how it can be different. And I want to know that Labour's actually talking to people in Europe, talking to colleagues in France and Germany, and discussing how to make it better and how you can restructure it.
OK, let's get some questions out. And they can, of course, be on Europe or on the Labour stuff. And we'll just do them one at a time.
What are the panel's two best policies to put to the high-level committee of economists that Corbyn has surrounded himself with, including Anne Pettifer, who was talking about this earlier today, that would make a difference? Which is, he has posed the two correct questions, i.e. that there is money around and the kind of austerity you're facing is not the right kind of austerity. He needs some answers now. What answers have you got that would help him?
Matt, do you want to have a go?
I'd move away from an income tax model. I don't think it is the best way to get money from the most affluent. Look at a more creative way of taxation. I would make charity giving easier, including to public services, and I would reassess Labour's. No, I'll leave it at those two.
Hugh, do you want to go? Give us two brainwaves.
Two big things. I mean, I certainly think he should do something about the kind of oligarchization of London. I think that's had manifold and manifest serious effects in London, and then a knock-on effect for the rest of the country in terms of the southeast overheating. So I really think he should do something like that. And I suppose in terms of what he says about corporations and making them pay their full whack, I think that's a really good idea, but I'm not sure that he's got the... they're pretty tricky corporations. If they were going to pay their full whack, they would have been doing it from that. They've been doing it already. The only way I've seen thus far to make them is, I think that we have so many tools at our disposal now as regards transparency, and I think that we really need much more transparency, much more in terms of legislation, in terms of punitive measures to make companies be more transparent about what they're doing here?
Anne? Yeah, like all of those, I would. I want to see really serious commitment to backing industrial innovation and an innovation fund, and I want to see the most possible investment in 16 plus education, and I mean most particularly FEs and the prospect for lifelong learning, so that everyone can reskill and get access to more training and have a better chance of getting a decent job.
It's interesting, Scylla, no one yet is talking about the banks, so you do your two as well.
But. Yeah, I don't disagree with any of these. There are two things immediately I'm going to be lobbying for within the Labour movement. First and foremost, I want us to use our collective money to renegotiate PFI debt. This country is spending £10 billion a year on debt repayments for PFI deals. We've done deals. Like, the worst thing in the world to do would be to try and write it off, because nobody will ever lend to the public sector again. So you've got to renegotiate it. And actually, there are models to be able to do that. My local hospital is under real threat because of the amount of debt that it has. Mm-hmm. In Northumbria, they renegotiated the debt. They're saving millions of pounds a year. So renegotiating the debt. Second thing I would do is I would reject this idea about that nationalisation is the way to go. I'm not a fan of faceless bureaucracies in the public or the private sector. Anybody in London who's ever dealt with TfL knows it's not about public ownership in that sense. And because I'm a co-op MP, I will be championing and promoting mutual models of ownership. So I want to see our railways not nationalised, but mutualised. I want to see TfL mutualised. I think there are creative ways that we could use the fines that we have on our public utilities to mutualise them and give the people real direct power and control over the services that matter in their lives. Because you cannot build national institutions that can respond quickly enough to the changes in the world economy. People respond much better. So let's organise people to do it through mutualisation.
So lots of ideas there. Can I just press you on this thing about the deficit? Because George Osborne still makes that sound like it's the only thing in the economy that matters. Do you think Labour's...
Oh, God, look, I want to get the deficit down because I don't want us to be paying any more money to banks than we have to. Mm. I mean, come on, the left should never see the idea that the deficit is a good thing.
What we've got
to recognise is, how do we make sure that we are investing to save? Why does it matter to invest in infrastructure, whether it is science, whether it is our roads? Because actually it's a saving. Why are the choices that George Osborne is making right now? Like, George Osborne, if he was the finance director of your company, he's come to you every single year for the last 6 years, he's got his sums wrong, he's asked for more money, and we've given it to him. In any other industry, you'd sack him. That's what we need to do. So getting the deficit down is absolutely about making good decisions. We should never cede the idea that public value for money is a right-wing thing. It's a very progressive thing to want to do.
OK, let's get another question here at the front.
Thank you. I think a number of MPs, commentators, comedians, etc., agree that there should be some kind of new party, or at least the shedding of party labels and a joining of different parties. I know Labour has the co-op part, but there seems to be Greens, also Catherine with what seems like a feminist party. I want to ask Stella, how would you feel about heading something like that, but still being active? And also, does the panel think that kind of thing should be something that we bring into power?
So I disagree very strongly with Matt in terms of ideology. Ideology matters to me more. Tribalism is what has to end. So I will work with people in other political parties on issues because I'm very ideological. But I know why I'm not a Green. Because zero growth harms the poorest, most vulnerable people in our communities. I represent a community. If you had zero growth, they don't have the assets to be able to succeed in that world. That's why the Greens' ideas about the economy are fundamentally wrong for the people of this country. My challenge with the Women's Equality Party, I have a lot of respect for those people. I was there the night that they invented it. I was one of the speakers on the panel where they felt they needed to do it. My concern is they're not radical enough. I don't want to fight for women to face the same working conditions as men. I want to fight for a completely different working environment where both men and women are equal. So we're not fighting for men and women to fight long hours. We're fighting for a different world altogether. Now, I'm a passionate feminist. I'm a passionate socialist. I recognise the challenge within the Labour movement right now. I'll be upfront about it. We have a piece of work to do about what we mean by equality, not just in our representation, but in our policies. But I'm going to fight those policies within the Labour movement because I want a much more radical Britain, not less.
Let's each of the other of us just have a minute on whether the party system is what John Reid would call not fit for purpose anymore. Didn't look it in Scotland, did it, after what happened in May?
Well, I mean, you could argue the party system worked in Scotland in terms of what happened after May, if you're a member of the SNP.
But could something comparable, not the SNP, but maybe, something comparable happen everywhere else? That's really what I'm asking.
The reason why I disagree with this idea that people should break off is the lesson of the SDP, is that even if the public aren't that ideological, they need to know that the Tories are broadly on the centre-right and that Labour are broadly on the centre-left, and that there's a direction that you're taking that's an alternative. I think that's important I don't think the death of ideology in terms of the public's view necessarily means that they don't occasionally think about whether they would want to go in a different direction. I think it's just that the direction has narrowed somewhat, and I think that's a positive change. If you leave the Labour Party, you really will struggle to defeat it. The British left, specifically the English left, will struggle to come up with something as popular as Labour. And the SDP proved that. And I think actually it's an argument that a lot of people on the left of the Labour Party like to peddle, which is, oh, well, if you don't like it, just leave, which is the worst possible option. Why don't the Blairites just form their own party? Well, they did, and they won three elections with it. And that's the best way to win, is to keep talented people in the fold, not trying to exclude them.
Hugh, do you think in, say, 15 years' time, we'll still have this idea that there's basically two big parties, or do you think that'll be gone?
I don't think we will. I think I can't see how post-Europe the Tories hold together particularly, and I'm not sure that Labour hold together. It's been very difficult for Labour to hold together the way things look at the moment. I am more and more... Having covered City Hall in London for a few years, I'd lean towards some kind of electoral reform. I would spent years kind of worrying about what that would mean in terms of fringe parties and loony parties and things like that. I'm kind of less worried about that. I think
we're all loonies now.
I think the reason why we keep coming back to two parties is because of the electoral system. Yeah. It excludes minority small parties until another one manages to kind of capture it. So we've got to have electoral reform. It's got to be high on Labour's agenda. And then we've got to get used to coalitions.
I've always been a campaigner for electoral reform. But I also think ideas matter. Look, what the public want to know is what kind of values do you have? Because you can get overwhelmed with all sorts of things. My concern about, and I do represent two political parties, but the point is you have an electoral pact because you recognise what you've got in common, and you don't undermine the forms of power you have, whether it's within your community, whether it's consumer power, social power, or political power, by acting against that. So for me, it's about how do we strengthen the idea that both ideas matter and the ability to put them into practice does too. That's where the electoral pact comes along. That's where, for me, when I disagree with other political parties, I don't want to do things to promote the Greens because I fundamentally disagree with them. But I hope that's an honourable disagreement rather than a tribal one.
I think it's no bad thing if you have to persuade them.
I just want to talk about the topic of climate change. I think in the public narrative, it seems to, and forum, it seems to have kind of dropped off even with on the left in prominence. And with the sort of Paris summit with sort of less than a month away, should Labour and the left start talking more about climate change and raise it on the agenda?
What do you think, Hugh? Is it doable in a mood where people are still feeling such a pinch?
I think it's about courage, really. I think that we've got... The whole idea of calling yourself the leader is that you're supposed to lead, and I think what's happened in politics too much... in my lifetime, but certainly the last decade or so, is that people think, well, what do the public think? Well, I'll park myself there. And I think, you know, that's why David Cameron decided that he should cut the green crap, because he just thought, well, no one's really interested in that. Well, one of the things you're supposed to do is, having looked at all of the evidence, to make people interested in it, because it is important.
Yeah, I want to know what you did with the husky.
Like Mrs. Thatcher's car.
Never seen again. Yeah.
Stuffed and living in Notting Hill. Anne, you write a lot about climate change, don't you?
I'm just wondering if maybe it's kind of coming of age as a political issue. I'm not at all sure about this, and like you, I'm very anxious at the low expectations of Paris, the lack of energy and excitement around it. But I think the kind of straw one can cling to is that greening policies are being adapted more and more widely. I mean, whatever we think of the ambition of China's targets, at least it's set targets, at least it's set a kind of peak coal point at which it will start to retreat. And Obama's just latterly, you know, he's kind of really taken on climate change policies and the oil exploration and development as a legacy issue. And so that's got to be good. But, you know, this is such a big subject, and it's going to take so long to turn our economies round. And in a way, we want everybody to be doing it. And it's almost better to do it quietly than to risk setting up opposition by being too noisy about it.
I completely disagree. Yeah. Because I just don't think we've got time. You look at the possibility of reaching the 2 degrees target, and it's getting further and further away. You know? And it's also impacting our economy. Look, we've just seen on the steel industry, it's partly because of what China is doing in terms of, and I'm very worried that what China is doing might end up being like oil for the Chinese in terms of controlling the steel industry in the future. But there are massive environmental implications of that, and there are jobs implications. Towns like Redcar are going to the wall because this government is standing by. The question about Paris and the question about that conference is, I don't think we have any choice but to be radical about the targets that we're looking for, and the European Union setting a much tougher target, because in 10 years' time it's going to have to be even tougher still to try and catch up with the difference.
So let's go for one that people can buy into now and ratchet it up. That's what we've got to aim.
You've made this hard-headed case that people only care about their jobs and their homes and their immediate town. Can they care about climate change enough for it to swing votes?
I'm going to alienate what little support I ever had in this audience and say, I really struggle to give a shit about climate change. I really do. I'm left wing, I recycle, I know ice is melting and the problems it causes. I know that the economic effects of it are severe when they happen. In general, in terms of daily life, it doesn't. I can only say that on some level.
But would you be
indeed? Okay. It just does as a political issue. It doesn't get me.
Would
excited.
You make policy on the basis of that though? If you were
no, of course
charge?
Not. But I'm not a politician. I'm a comedian, and I'm just talking from the heart. I think part of the reason why it's down the agenda is most people actually don't care that much.
Okay, let's have one more question, which is all we've got time for. Lady in the turquoise top there.
Hello. You talked about leadership and the idea that leaders should lead, but actually, is that the right thing to be thinking in this day and age? You know, I work locally with an organisation where they talk about everybody being a leader. So I think we've got quite a lot of confusion about what we actually mean by the term leadership.
Go first, Matt.
I absolutely want strong leaders. Leadership is a skill. And you devolve a certain amount of power to a leader when you say, effectively, within a parliamentary party, within an organisation, that is your job, is to chart a course, use the skills of the people around you, but let's not pretend you can do everything by committee. As a country, I think there's a certain amount of security that the people have in seeing a leader that they perceive to be competent. They don't agree with everything that they do. They probably disagree with most of what they do, but on the whole, they think that's a person that, given the other choices, I would rather have. And I think the left has an ideological problem with leadership. And I think you've seen that throughout the phenomenon of Corbynism. This is somehow that, leaders are arrogant and they think they know right. Absolutely right. And because that's why they want to be a leader. And I want to back someone who thinks they're right, and I want to back someone who takes the time to talk to other people and then reaches a decision.
I think
leadership is a strong skill we should champion, not be afraid of and shy away from.
Look at Nicola Sturgeon as somebody who manages both to project the idea of strong leadership, but is also... certainly was in the days when she was leading a coalition in Edinburgh. She learned ways of cooperating in government that I think strengthened immeasurably and were very innovative about sharing political power. So I think you can actually have both. But I know what you're saying, and I think that there is a balance between the kind of macho pose and.
But that's it. Just the presumption that it's macho. Is a major, major problem with left-wing politics at the moment.
And
good leaders
long
inspire.
Margaret Thatcher,
there's nothing macho about that.
But of course, in many cases, leaders will actually be the people who are privy to the information, particularly in something in terms of climate change. I mean, the disgrace of Cameron in Cut the Green Crab is that he gets all the papers. He knows what the implications of that are. And yet he does it anyway. Your man on the doorstep your woman on the doorstep who might need persuading, they don't have that information. It's your job then to say, actually, having looked at all this stuff, I can tell you that what your immediate perception of this is not right.
Stella, okay, it's a question up your street, this, isn't it?
Different perspective to Matt, but different perspective to the kind of idea that it's matching. Absolutely, you need leadership. You need to be able to persuade. That's what I see leadership as being about, saying there are some difficult choices here for us all to make. The flip side of this, though, is the bystander culture. Nothing is going to change because of a few small people, whether they're in government, whether they're on a local community. Actually, all the challenges we face in the next 50 years as a society, they're different to 50 years ago when it was about you build an NHS and that stops people dying of TB. Now people are dying of heart disease, diabetes, complications with diseases that are sometimes connected to their lifestyles. That means they have to make different choices, and we have to support and help them to do that. And actually, on the left, there is an arrogance that says, we come and we fight for services for you, don't push back, don't come and go with your idea. So people were challenged about the idea of choice because they thought, well, that's giving away control. It's about choice and voice. So the issue for the left is both to show leadership and say, we have an alternative vision, but also say, and here's the part you have to play in it, because that's how we will all do better. Left-wing politics is about how we get the best out of each of us for the benefit of all of us. That is different in the 21st century. That's the leadership we've got to get right.
Well, that philosophical note draws things to a close for this time. My thanks to Matt Ford, to Stella Creasy, to Hugh Muir, and to Anne Perkins, as well as to all of you who've taken the time to come and listen to us here. The producer of Politics Weekly is Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much to all of you for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.